This is Taking Aim with
Rob Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. We're glad to have you back with us for the second part of our discussion about the World Trade Center and the WTC Twin Towers and Building 7 and why the explosions of 9/11 were a controlled demolition. There's been an official fiction for a long time. Many of us are trying for an independent investigation. And most of all, we have now architects and engineers throughout the country, spearheaded by one here in Berkeley, California, Richard Gage, AIA, over 20 years an architect, as he says, coming from being a Reagan Republican to have his eyes opened and now leading the charge among architects and engineers for discovering the truth about 9/11 and stating conclusively after their initial investigation that these were controlled demolitions. We have for you our premium, our donation to you for your wonderful contribution to WBAI, keeping WBAI on the air, this fantastic two-hour DVD, 9/11 Blueprint for Truth, The Architecture of Discussion. It is a two-hour presentation by Richard Gage that was recorded May 18, 2008 in San Rafael. Those of you who listened last week or went to our program archive and heard our show last week heard excerpts from the first part of the presentation about the collapse of the WTC 7, where there was not even an airplane that could have that hit it. And there was an incredible collapse of this building. And Richard, in this DVD, shows you why this, the only explanation for the collapse of WT7 is a controlled demolition. Now, today, we're going to World Trade Center Twin Towers. Incredible architectural feats and engineering feats. And they, too, conclusively, Richard states, were controlled demolitions. So we're going to start, after this brief comment by Ralph, going to the DVD. Get on the phone right away during these excerpts, 212-209-2950. Richard will be joining us at 2:30 for a discussion, and please keep those phones ringing. This is our last day for the WBAI Fund Drive. We're off the air at 6 o'clock. You're going to have only this hour to make your contribution to show WBAI that you want to keep your station, your listener-sponsored station, your free speech avenue to the world of news and music and culture on the air. 212-209-2950. Ralph?
Well, Maya, I'm going to take a moment to bring to our listeners' attention a current false flag operation which extraordinarily echoes and mimics, if you like, the controlled demolition at the World Trade Center towers. 17 minutes ago, the Secretary of Defense, Gates, declared that the United States was a willing anti-extremism partner in Pakistan. And citing the explosion at the Marriott, he called upon Pakistan to affirm the United States' right to take military action against, quote, extremists in Pakistan, and demanded that the new government in Islamabad join the U.S. in facing what he called a common existential threat. Well, brothers and sisters, the size of that explosion at the Marriott was equivalent to a kiloton nuclear bomb. It would have required a truck that was capable of holding 100 tons to have managed it. There was no such truck of that size, nor was the initial explosion in the truck of that magnitude. And what is reported is that on floors 4 and 5 of the Marriott Hotel in Islamabad, and I know that hotel well, having had dinner there less than a year ago with the Pakistani officials with whom I was in touch. Let me just point out to you that on floors 4 and 5, the United States Marine had stored steel boxes that were shifted inside the hotel, without passing through scanners at the entrance of the hotel lobby, shifted throughout the 4th and 5th floors of the Marriott, and kept from all Pakistan security officials, either to observe or to obstruct. and indeed the Marines were in control of this operation, U.S. Marines, steel boxes with gas pipelines throughout floors 4 and 5. We'll go into more of this, brothers and sisters, in a full-scale program of taking aim. False flag operation, standard procedure. Bring down a building, impute it to extremists, and terrorize the population into accepting U.S. agenda, long in planning, much in operation as we speak.
9/11, Blueprint for Truth, the Architecture of Destruction. Let's go to the excerpts.
As clear as the evidence is for the destruction of Building 7 by explosives, the evidence is even more clear in the case of the Twin Towers. When you look at it with a new pair of glasses and looking at the forensic science-based evidence, let's get introduced here. Some called it the crowning achievement of the international style, this pair of buildings. Others, heartless modernism. In fact, architect Robert Stern calls it gigantic dumbness, right? It's two squares extruded just to the point where they become the highest buildings in the world. Either way, no matter how you feel about these buildings, they did have innovative structural engineering led by John Skilling and his aide, Leslie Robertson, who helped Minoru Yamasaki preserve the simple sculptural purity of his forms. And you can compare this building to the elegant Art Deco of the Empire State Building and come to your own conclusions about design. But it did eclipse the highest building in the world in 1976, but just for a couple of years until the Sears Tower outgrew it. The structural engineering innovations were quite extraordinary, lending the award, the engineering project that demonstrates the greatest engineering skills and represents the greatest contribution to engineering progress and mankind, by the American Society of Civil Engineers. Let's take a look at what we achieved. We have 60-foot spans. We have a perimeter structure, which is like a tube structure, and this inner core. Let's take a look at it. Most high-rises up to this time were built on a dense grid of steel or concrete frames all the way throughout the building in a 20 or 30-foot grid. The Twin Towers were built as a tube structure with a very dense, strong mesh of steel surrounding the exterior and acting as a bearing wall, which resists the lateral loads, earthquake, and in the case of this building, particularly wind, hurricanes up to 140 miles an hour it was designed to resist. This perimeter structure was 14-inch columns, 3 foot 9 inches on center. Inside was this core, a dense grid of 47 immense box columns, 4-inch thick at the base, 2-inch thick at mid-height. Prefabricated floor assemblies with 22-gauge steel decking, over which was poured reinforced concrete and held up by 29-inch deep open-web steel trusses. All of this was completely pulverized on 9/11. We'll take a look at that. Now, these trusses were bolted to the perimeter columns and the core columns with these 5/8-inch bolts. This is a structure within a structure. This dense core structure would have remained standing 1,300 feet in the air if this surrounding less strong floor structure were to have collapsed around it. In fact, the perimeter structure probably would have been left standing for a while until its lack of support gave in. This is the core columns, 52 inches by 22 inches along the long edge, almost solid steel at the bottom, continuously welded from the bottom all the way to the top. Now, any 1,800-degree fire would have been almost immediately conducted throughout this 100,000-ton heat sink. That's the reason there's been no collapse of steel frame high-rise fires, because of the steel. Hold a spoon over the stove. See how long you can hang on to it. Almost instantly, you'll be forced to let it go. Let's take a look at the structural imperative that was given to John Skilling.
John Skilling and Les Robertson were the structural engineers who designed the streamlined steel frames of the Twin Towers in the 1960s. Because a wayward Army bomber flew into the Empire State Building in 1945, the towers were built with skyscraper crashes in mind.
We had designed the project for the impact of the our largest airplane of its time, the Boeing 707. That is to take this jet airplane, run it into the building, destroy a lot of structure, and still have it stand up.
The building was designed to have a fully loaded 707 crash into it. That was the largest plane at the time. I believe that the building probably could sustain multiple impacts of jetliners because this structure is like the mosquito netting on your screen door, this intense grid, and the jet plane is just a pencil puncturing that screen netting. It really does nothing to the screen netting.
A very robust structure, in fact. The forces coming down routed themselves around. They arched around the opening created by the airplane. In fact, Iger says the towers withstood the initial impact of the aircraft. This ability to withstand the initial impact is hardly surprising, given the robust nature. Now, we have the North Tower being hit at 8:46 in the morning, and about 102 minutes later, after fires traveled around the floors and up the floors in the case of the North Tower, the building did collapse. The South Tower was hit about 15 minutes later, and after only about 56 minutes, it collapses as the fires were in fact diminishing severely. Gilling noted that he designed the towers to take a hit from a Boeing 707 traveling 600 miles an hour. When he was asked if he considered plane crashes, he cites, "Our analysis indicated the biggest problem would be the fact that all the fuel would dump into the building, but the building structure would still be there." This is FEMA's theory. We have the sagging of the trusses and the pulling away from the column, and then the subsequent pancaking down. Again, the trusses, one after the other, 6 foot, 8 inches, every truss disengaging from the perimeter wall, which would have to be, at the rate that these buildings fell, that would have been at the speed of sound, the disengagement from one truss to the next, all the way around the building, and then the next floor and the next floor and the next floor. NIST turns it around and blames the persistence of these connections pulling in the columns, causing the columns to buckle. Now, it's generally more difficult for people to understand that the towers were a controlled demolition because it was so outside of our frame of reference. We'd never seen anything like this. But if you were to plan a fire-induced collapse as a result of airplanes, you'd start the explosions at the point of jet plane impacts. In World Trade Center 2 and 1, we have all of the key characteristic features of controlled demolitions, but with some of these key differences. We have a beginning of detonation at the point of jet plane impacts, not at the base of the building. In addition, we have not an implosion, but where everything is being exploded outside the footprint. We have squibs, or these mistimed explosions, that occur 20, 40, and even 60 stories down below. And as we already discussed the evidence for thermite in the molten metal and in the dust in the iron-rich microspheres. So let's take a look, starting with the sudden onset. What is the evidence for this, and how is it produced? Produced by these sounds and flashes from the explosions. Now, the city's fire commissioner, Thomas von Essen, requires all of his EMTs and firefighters to record their experiences, about 500 of them, and in 12,000 pages, as it turns out, collected from 2001 to 2002, the New York State Court of Appeals overturns the city's request to hold on to this information against the lawsuit by the New York Times. They failed, and why was the city holding on to this information? Was it because 118 of these firefighters witnessed sounds and flashes of explosions? We felt the ground shake. You could see the tower sway, and then it just came down. All of a sudden, the ground just started shaking. It shook my bones. Shortly before the first tower came down, I remember feeling the ground shaking. Somewhere around the middle of the World Trade Center, there was this orange and red flash coming out. Initially, just one flash. Then it just kept popping all the way around the building. The building had started to explode. It's like on television, they blow up these buildings. Seemed like it was going all the way around, like a belt, all these explosions. Pop, 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 that's when I heard the building coming down. Saw a brief number of light sources being emitted from inside the building between floors 10 and 15. I saw low-level flashes. We actually heard the pops. You know, you heard the pops of the building. It was blowing out on all four sides. With each popping sound, it was initially an orange, and then a red flash came out of the building. Then it would just go around the building on both sides. I saw flash, 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 and then it looked like the building came down. Well, you can hear that explosive in this video.
Yeah, here's one of the guys who can tell you I'm okay, all right? Here, hold on. You want to call, you want to call your mother or something?
Does that sound like a fire or collapsing floors? None of these explosions are a part of the official story. The antenna falls about 12 meters first before anything else falls, indicating core column damage, not trusses pulling away from the perimeter columns. Now take a look at the same tower from the bottom, noting the violence underneath the mushroom cloud. The collapse is supposed to be occurring way up here, but down below, as you'll see in this second run, incredible quantities of squibs, explosions bursting out. And on the third time, I'd like to direct your attention to this racing series of explosions down the right side in the corner of this building, about 40 stories below the collapsing building. It gets painfully obvious after a while, doesn't it? Note these multiple nodes of these independent explosions. Do we have a straight down symmetrical progression of collapse outside the footprint? We had a 207-foot wide building. FEMA tells us, and you can see in this document, that we have a 1,200-foot debris field equidistant around each tower. Asymmetrical damage, symmetrical distribution, all through the site, in fact, and beyond. Do we have squibs or these mistimed explosions? Some believe that these might be appropriately timed explosions.
In all the videos of the collapses, explosions can be seen bursting from the building 20 to 30 stories below the demolition wave. Here. 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 And here.
Now, NIST tells us that these are puffs of air being produced by the collapsing building pushing air down the hoistway like a piston. It's got to come out somewhere, right? Well, first of all, these are not puffs of air. They're pulverized building materials. And they occur at 160 to 200 feet, some of them, per second. These velocities are propelled by explosives. 20, 40, and 60 stories below, how can the piston be producing all of that? And in fact, there are these focalized ejections that occur halfway between the corners of the building. Also, if say this was the open office space, right, 60 feet long, the elevator hoistway is over here, the piston's going to shove the air into this room. It's going to fill the room fairly uniformly with air pressure before it breaks any windows, and then it might break several, but not these highly focalized, pinpoint accurate, geometrically precise, violent ejections. No, it's extremely unlikely. But let's look at a couple of them here.
As the south tower begins to explode, we track two squibs near the bottom of the frame. They shoot out quickly at first, then slow and merge in with the rest of the dust cloud. Using the first few data points, we see the first squib shoots out at 44.98 meters per second, or about 100 miles per hour. Doing the same for the second squib, we get a speed of 56.3 meters per second, which works out closer to 126 miles per hour.
126 miles per hour of almost instant ejection velocity? Does fire create that? Do we have a near free fall pace through the path of greatest resistance? Let's take a look.
Galileo's law of falling bodies calculates the time in which an object will travel a certain distance in complete free fall. Distance, d, equals 16.8 times time in seconds squared. The South Tower was 1,362 feet tall. 1362 equals 16.08 times 84.7, or 9.2 seconds. The Twin Towers came down in nearly free fall speed.
What are we talking about here? Let's just try to put this in perspective with this story problem. We have a 15-story building which we hold with this crane over 95 stories of nothing but air. No resistance, right? Just air resistance. Next to it, another 15-story building held over a 95-story building with, say, 80,000 tons of structural steel in it. Now we're going to pull the lever on these cranes and drop them both at once. I brought a 95-story building with me today. And we're going to just test this theory of NIST's. I've got two 15-story buildings. We've got 80,000 tons of structural steel in this one right here. And we got air resistance here. So let's try it, okay? We'll put them both up here. We'll even give a little bit of impact load, too, okay? Ready? 3, 2, 1. Oh, my God. The one without any resistance under it hit the ground first at virtually free fall speed. This doesn't take much, does it? What happened over here? The building above met resistance. Through the energy of deformation, it came to a halt. In fact, you'll find on our website, ae911truth.org, that Ken Cutler and Gordon Ross produce these papers, and they show and calculate that, in fact, the building's downward momentum would have been almost immediately arrested. That where is the 15-story building that was driving this building down to the ground at free fall speed? In the first 2 seconds, you saw it reduce half of its mass. It was blown outside. It couldn't have been used to influence the downward progression of the building. In the next 2 seconds, after 4 seconds totally, it's destroyed itself. There's nothing crushing the building. It's tearing itself apart at free fall speed. And it's dismembering the steel structure. In fact, the leading edge of these mushroom clouds are full of perimeter columns, aluminum cladding, and other steel. Let's take a look at the South Tower in terms of dismemberment. See what's going on here. South Tower's on your left. It was hit lower by the aircraft. And as you can see, its descent starts, its rapid destruction starts there, and it begins to tilt to the left. And it disappears into this cloud. We would expect to see this building, which is already tilted at 22 degrees and continuing its angular momentum, off center of the building below it. How can it crush it symmetrically at free fall speed when it's already off center? And we don't see it either mangled up in some heap at the bottom down on the pavement. It's been completely dismembered. Let's take a look from below, though. We have asymmetrical damage, and yet there's this symmetrical destruction occurring underneath the cloud, all the way around the building like the firemen saw, even though this top mass has already fallen over. Free fall speed. Doesn't make sense to me. Steel frame structure was completely dismembered. There are no large chunks of building, only those shards that we saw of the perimeter structure. Does it look like a gravitational collapse to you? Do we have a lateral ejection of structural steel? Let's take a look.
Now let's look at the collapse of the Twin Towers. We are seeing explosions rather than implosions, a first in demolition history. A sequenced rumble becomes a roar as debris is thrown outward. The damage is not contained. Windows are blown from neighborhood buildings. What kind of energy enabled this? Would fire hurl metal and concrete sideways into the air? Here, a chunk of steel was flung 400 feet, wedging itself deep into Three World Financial Center on Fezzi Street. A FEMA photographer taking pictures of Ground Zero wondered why so many steel beams were jutting from neighborhood buildings. What shot pieces of the towers all the way across the street?
In fact, the portions of the tower that had the greatest structural members, the sky lobbies and the mechanical floors, had the perimeter units thrown farther than the perimeter wall units from the upper floors, which theoretically should have, because they're higher, they should have gone farther, right? No, these perimeter units landed on the Winter Garden 600 feet away. Let's take a look at the physics of this.
Girders weighing several tons were found 600 feet from the base of the North Tower. How fast they were ejected depends on where they originated. If they came from high in the building, they were thrown outward at about 50 miles per hour. If they came from lower down, the speed had to be even greater. Gravity alone cannot account for such high lateral ejection speeds.
In fact, let's take a look at a couple of these specific ejections.
Using special software, we can analyze motion on video clips frame by frame. I have placed markers on each frame so we can track a particular projectile. From the markers, we can get a data table and plot various graphs. The data here shows that the object we are tracking was shot horizontally at over 70 miles per hour. The energy needed to hurl a 4-ton girder at this speed is comparable to the energy needed to hurl a 200-pound cannonball 3 miles.
What about those floors, those pancakes? This is a pancake collapse. We're looking for some pancakes down below. This is a 7-story lobby. There's about 2 or 3 stories of stuff in there. We'll take a look at that stuff, but what I'm looking for is 110 floors with this kind of metal decking underneath 4 and 5 inches thick of concrete.
This is Taking Aim with
Rosh Unman
and Maya Schoen. We've been listening to 2 further excerpts from 9/11 Blueprint for Truth, The Architecture of Destruction. Presentation by Richard Gage, AIA. It's a 2-hour DVD for your $75 contribution to WBAI. Impressive. That is the word that I must use in describing this presentation. Richard is on the air with us now. Hello, Richard. Oh, not yet. Okay. So let's tell you a little bit more about this incredible DVD. Get on the phone, 212-209-2950. Along with the DVD, Ralph, Richard has presented 3 incredible postcards, and one of them, the WTC Towers, describes the explosive evidence. 15 reasons why this is definitely a controlled demolition. Ralph?
Here is what is significant about this presentation by Richard Gage, the DVD, and the exhibits, the visual exhibits, the demonstration of what actually took place. What is so important about this is not merely how Richard demolishes the official fiction regarding the collapse of the trade towers. It's not merely because a hydrocarbon fire cannot reach temperatures sufficient to compromise the integrity of steel and reinforced concrete, reducing them to molten liquid and to powder, respectively. It's because what Richard has done is to demonstrate how the explosions were placed, to show you visually the explosions occurring, to play the soundtrack of the explosions as they go off, to produce the witnesses, to have the reports on the U.S. television and radio, those reports subsequently censored and removed. On the at-time reports, recording documenting the explosions and their impact, to produce the witnesses, the eyewitnesses, the firemen, the policemen, the survivors, the actual participants in the event who went through the explosions, who identified them, who are on camera and on soundtrack. Brothers and sisters, there is no way, after watching this and having this at your disposal, that you can in any way resist the obvious that this was a government operation, a controlled demolition. The placement of these explosives, the location of these explosives, the detonation of these explosives, the impact on the building as you watch it, the description by the witnesses, compounding the evidence with their dramatic first-hand eyewitness testimony is literally a bombshell in itself.
Oh, Richard, hi. Glad to have you with us.
Hello, Maya and Ralph. It's great to be here with you again.
Richard was just getting off the radio with Denver. He's going to be speaking in Denver, Colorado. Isn't that so?
Indeed, on Thursday night. If anybody can fly out to Denver and see me, I'd love to meet them.
Well, Richard, I was looking at one of the cards and in which you say why architects and engineers are reexamining the destruction of the World Trade Center, and you mentioned 4 to 20-ton steel column beam sections were severed at their connections and hurled into the sides of neighboring buildings 2 football fields away, and how the fire department found several tons of molten metal flowing like lava. And that microspheres formed from molten iron, which are the byproduct of thermite, were found in the WTC dust by U.S. agencies, environmental firms, and independent physicists. These are just 3 of the many reasons. But could you go into, for our listeners, how the buildings were brought down?
Well, we clearly have ample evidence of explosive controlled demolition. And what we start with in the Twin Towers is the eyewitnesses, of which over 100 were recorded on tape as seeing explosions wrapping all the way around the building like a belt, many of them said. They saw flashes of light. And this is at the onset of the collapse and the ensuing so-called collapse. These are credible eyewitnesses. In fact, down on the ground, there's numerous newspaper reporters and on video. They hear the explosions all the way down in the street and recording them, responding to them 1,700 feet away, ducking in light of this incredible explosive event, which, as you said, sent 4-ton perimeter wall units 600 feet away at 55 miles an hour minimum. What happens is we have 110 floors in these buildings, and guess how many of them are found at the bottom of either Twin Tower? Hey, I'd settle for 50, maybe half of them, but we don't find 20. We don't even find one floor in this supposedly pancake collapse down at the bottom. Where are they? Everything has been systematically pulverized, 90,000 tons of concrete, most of which is a fine powder. The metal decking on which the concrete is poured has been completely pulverized to fine angular elements that you find in all of the World Trade Center dust. It comes right up to a magnet. That's the only evidence we have for the 220 acres of metal decking. And guess what's in all of the concrete? We have the chemical evidence of thermite, a high-tech incendiary used to cut through steel like a hot knife through butter. This is in the iron-rich microspheres, which are a byproduct of molten iron under extremely explosive conditions. Where does all the molten iron come from? Well, it's the byproduct of thermite, and it's seen, tons of it is seen by the first responders underneath the basements, the World Trade Center towers, and under Building 7 as well. Here's the problem. The molten iron, it still doesn't even begin to melt until 3,000 degrees. So we have fires that can only produce 1,200, 1,400 degrees. Even jet fuel doesn't burn that hot. So what produced all that molten iron? It wasn't the fire. This is why NIST, the National Institute of Standards and Technology, basically denied that there was any molten metal found. In fact, they categorically deny it. And then later in their questions, they start to try to explain it away as saying, well, it got hot under there because it was so insulated. You can't raise the temperature of something in an insulated condition from something like 1,000 degrees to 3 or 4,000 degrees flowing molten iron. No, this is a byproduct of thermite. The molten iron has in it chemical evidence of thermite, and the iron-rich microspheres produced when the surface tension of liquid in a dispersed condition produces this, and then it cools into these little tiny balls that fall everywhere, and they're laced throughout all of the dust. So this is corroborated by R.J. Lee and USGS in their toxicological studies. They find the iron-rich microspheres. They have no idea where they came from.
Well, Richard, let's remind people to call 212-209-2950. As absorbed as you are listening to Richard now, you will be more so when you have the opportunity to watch this two-hour DVD and invite friends over and watch it together and have a discussion about what can be done. 212-209-2950. Ralph?
Well, Maya, we've been listening to Richard, and we've been hearing the extraordinary evidence, the massive evidence that is marshaled here, not merely on why the towers cannot be accounted for in their collapse by the official fiction and the hydrocarbon fire and the impact of airplanes, but the specifics of the controlled demolition, the explosions, where they occurred, when they occurred, how they occurred, where they were placed, the eyewitnesses who heard them, the tape recordings and the TV broadcasts that document them. This is an extraordinary compilation. It is an integral, massive demonstration of the false flag operation that was 9/11 and the attack upon the World Trade Towers. And I want to just take a brief moment to flash forward to today, brothers and sisters, today, because 17 minutes ago, the Secretary of Defense declared that Pakistan must acquiesce in American attacks in Pakistan and that the new government in Islamabad must face what is called a common existential threat and join with the United States in military action and to sanction U.S. raids and U.S. troops in Pakistan. What was the basis for calling upon the Pakistani regime to accept that it is facing an existential threat? The bombing at the Marriott Hotel in Islamabad. I know that hotel well. I was there with Tanvir Khan less than a year ago. Look at the crater, says the World News of Pakistan. It is enormous, 40 meters deep. The magnitude of that explosion, the report states, required a mini-nuke, something smaller, something 0.1 kiloton. I misspoke myself, not 1 kiloton, brothers and sisters, 1/10 of a kiloton, but a micro-nuke nonetheless. The blast would have required a truck that held over 100 tons or more. There was no such truck there and no such tonnage in that truck. Indeed, the report goes on, corroborated in World News out of Pakistan, that State Department officials led colleagues through rubble from the charred building, bleeding heavily from wounds. One of the four identified himself and said they'd been moving toward the rear of the restaurant inside the hotel after a blast, when a second explosion hurled them back. Then they saw a big truck coming to the gates. The explosions preceded the truck. Quote, after the blast, mysterious fires were started at the fourth and fifth floors. It was said that the fire was the result of gas pipeline bursts running through the hotel. But the million-dollar question, the Daily Pakistan Politics reports, is that the gas pipeline was running through all the other floors. Why did the fire break out on the fourth and fifth floors? The fire on the fourth and fifth floors broke out because these floors were housing mysterious steel boxes under the heavy guard of the United States Marines. No one, including Pakistani security forces and the security men of the hotel, were allowed to go near them. The boxes were shifted inside the hotel when U.S. Admiral Mike Mullen met Prime Minister Yusuf Rasul Gilani in Islamabad. One member of parliament, Mumtaz Alam of the PPP, the ruling party, eyewitnessed the entire scene. A white truck of the U.S. Embassy came to the gate of the Marriott Hotel. U.S. Marines loaded the steel boxes, unloaded them from the trucks, and shifted them to the fourth and fifth floors without passing through the scanners at the entrance of the hotel. The truck was there at the entrance. Exit passageways to the hotels were closed, and the blast occurred at the Marriott. While the mysterious activity was going on, the report continues. There is much detail here, brothers and sisters. False flag operation, controlled demolition, explosives that account for the destruction of this hotel with Pakistani high officials there, an immediate announcement by the U.S. Secretary of Defense as to what Pakistan must now do in the wake of this explosion, 9/11 redux. It's not just the controlled demolition of the World Trade Center, brothers and sisters. It's the control of our population, the terrorizing of our people, the facilitating of long-standing imperial designs. 9/11 is about imperialism unleashed, unbridled, unstopped. It's our responsibility to do something about this. This is the DVD you need to begin that process right here at home.
We have several things for you to do today. Get on the phone, call 212-209-2950, and have for yourself 9/11 Blueprint for Truth, The Architecture of Destruction, a beautiful set including the DVD, this two-hour marvelous presentation by Richard Gage, AIA, as well as these three incredibly nicely designed cards with the summary explanation about controlled demolition. Also, remember, if you live in New York City, please get involved with the independent investigation. That's the New York 9/11 ballot drive. Call the hotline 646-537-1755 or go to www.nyc911initiative.org. 30,000 people have already come on board and signed the petition, and we're trying to get over 100,000. We're going to have the definitive statement. Another thing that's taking place, talking about the entire thing that's happening in the United States now and the dispossession of the American people, working people throughout the world, too. And that is Thursday at 4 p.m., that's Thursday, September 25th, at the southern end of Bowling Green Park in the Plaza area. There's a large demonstration that's being planned to say no, we won't pay for the Wall Street bailout. So please, that's Thursday, 4 p.m. in New York City. Get on out there and say no to the Wall Street bailout. First and foremost, what are you going to do right now? Get on the phone, 212-209-2950. Show your support for Taking Aim. Demonstrate your support for WBAI. And most of all, get for yourself the information, the analysis that will empower you so that you, too, can join in the movement for a real investigation about the WTC. Let's put it to rest. Let's organize. Join us in organizing. Ralph?
9/11 Blueprint for Truth, The Architecture of Destruction. This is the demonstration, the evidence. Richard, would you address the question of thermite and how the particular chemical residues demonstrate how the steel was compromised, as you show in your DVD?
Yeah, indeed. Dr. Jones found unignited chips of thermite in all of the dust. He has four samples. Each sample shows these tiny chips. They're about a 16th of an inch long, many of them. There's red on one side, gray on the other. The red side is the mixture of extremely small nano-sized particles of aluminum and powder and iron oxide powder, along with manganese and potassium and other substances such as fluorine. Fluorine is an oxidizer in Sol-Gel-type thermites. This stuff can be tailor-made to reduce the explosiveness of it, even though there were plenty of explosions found. They're still not like the high-energy explosives used in classic controlled demolitions like RDX and C4. And thermite doesn't have the kind of the signature that tells you what manufacturer it came from either. So this may have been the reason that it was used. So we suggest the gray side, by the way, of these chips seems to have been some sort of primer. So it may have been painted on, sprayed on the column. And of course, what we have is a free fall speed of collapse almost in the Twin Towers. And so the columns have to have been removed, and within a tenth of a second of each other, floor by floor. Otherwise, this building would have tipped over. This was a very clearly an engineered process. That
now,
was
Richard,
not,
may I ask you, the thermite had an additive, I believe a sulfur additive, that converts it to thermate, which can account for the temperatures required to reduce this steel to molten liquid, and no other chemical mechanism can account for that. Is that not correct?
Well, sulfur lowers the melting point of steel, and we do have molten metal dripping out of the buckets of, on photographs on our website, ae911truth.org. You can see these photographs of this dripping molten metal. It's yellow or orange, indicating its temperature is like 1,800 degrees. So, indeed, it appears as if the sulfur was directly responsible, in this case, for lowering the temperature. And FUMA documents this extreme sulfidation on the one piece of steel they have that was survived from World Trade Center 7. All of the rest was systematically shipped to China under very suspicious circumstances. It's highly illegal to destroy
that's
the evidence.
That's right. Destroy the evidence. That way people don't have the evidence to investigate. But fortunately, some of it was retained.
Well, the extraordinary thing that Richard has documented here through the work of Stephen Jones, the courageous physicist from Brigham Young, who lost the position at Brigham Young precisely because of his seminal work on the actual chemical evidence for the introduction of an element that would raise temperatures to the point where the steel could be compromised. This had to be introduced. It is nothing natural to the World Trade Center. It was an introduced element that accounts for the accomplishment of compromising the integrity of the steel and the powder.
We have 100 examples of very hot, very large, and long-lasting fires in high-rises, and guess how many of them collapsed?
None.
None at all. Steel does not collapse in fire. It can weaken a little bit at high temperatures, but this steel is fireproof.
Since this building was designed to, these buildings were designed to withstand multiple impacts by 707s.
That's right.
Extremely large airplanes with a lot of fuel on board. That's exactly what was taken into account in the design of these buildings. Now, Richard, you in the DVD, in this lecture, you describe how the controlled demolition could be set. And before we go to that, I once again want to say 212-209-2950. We have less than 10 minutes to go. You have less than 10 minutes to get on the phone to call to have this in your home, 212-209-2950. We think this DVD is so important that we ourselves are distributing it to so many people. As you know, on Taking Aim, we bring to you people who we respect. Each week we prepare extensive, meticulous documentation and analysis for you. Believe me, Richard is a shining star on the research and the presentation about 9/11 and the physical evidence. When he talks about forensic evidence, he isn't saying it lightly. And you will be as impressed as we are by this presentation. 212-209-2950. Let's keep those volunteers in the pledge room busy. Let's keep those phones ringing. Richard, let's talk about the actual mechanism for the controlled demolition.
Well, people suggest, well, how could they have run miles of wires? There was 50,000 people in these buildings, after all. They would have been seen. Well, if you had access to the elevator hoistways in the center of the building, all of which are immediately adjacent to the core column structure throughout the building from bottom to top, you would be able to hack through the gypsum board enclosure and get off the fireproofing and plant these explosives however you wanted. But you'd need an excuse, such as, for instance, a elevator modernization, which indeed we have going on the 9 months prior to 9/11. ACE Elevator had the contract. We would like to see them ask some serious questions under oath. It would be very important. They have reorganized their company since then. And it's interesting to note that the elevator modernization workers ran off after the flames hit the buildings. They were not there to help the firemen rescue the people. And that is extremely unusual because they are relied upon for their expertise in the elevator and how they operate to help the firemen.
Right. And you see here, brothers and sisters, as Richard is describing it, the process through which not merely the detonation was accomplished and the witnesses are there to demonstrate what occurred, but you see as well the extraordinary steps taken by authority to suppress the evidence, destroy the evidence, to remove the evidence, and to prevent any understanding or examination of what occurred on September 11th. If anybody were injured in a car accident, it would receive a more thorough and serious investigation by authority than we have had in the circumstance of the attacks of September 11th. And this is the paradigm. When the Kennedy brothers are executed, when Martin Luther King is murdered, when Malcolm X is removed to execution, all of a sudden the evidence is no longer of interest to the authorities. The evidence has disappeared. The evidence is suppressed. The witnesses are terrorized, they drop like flies. The paradigm of what treason at the top requires repeats itself in every major criminal undertaking by the ruling class of the United States.
And as we've noted on prior Taking AIM shows, as the Project for New American Century stated explicitly in its document for President Bush during his campaign, Rebuilding America's Defenses, and as the Big Me of Brzezinski has noted time and again, particularly in the Grand Chessboard, you need essentially a new Pearl Harbor to get the American people on board for massive military operations, for permanent war.
Well, as Brzezinski articulated, and we've done this recently in a series of broadcasts, brothers and sisters, and in a series of important documents and papers prior to the book, The Grand Chessboard, Brzezinski laid out that a populist democracy, as he called it, is incompatible with the security pursuits of those in charge of the American polity. He stated, only when people are in dire fear from external threat can they be induced to accept what is necessary, what cannot be always outlined to them explicitly, but which must be implemented nonetheless. It is quite explicit, quite detailed, and quite elaborate as to what is required by the rulers to whipsaw a population into numbed acquiescence, into planned operations of long standing. This is the predicate for 9/11, and this scenario and this projection is not merely from Brzezinski. It is indeed the words of Condoleezza Rice. It was Michael Chertoff. It was Dov Zakheim, the controller of the Pentagon, who had command over, by the way, the disappearance of $7.2 trillion of accumulated Pentagon funds. These are, in fact, the architects, not just of 9/11, but the architects of our control by this tiny cabal, this criminal conspiracy at the height of power in the United States. These demonstrations through evidence, and this massively compiled evidence, the huge amount of data, and the emotional impact of observing it, of seeing it, of hearing it, of experiencing it in real time, are what we are offering, what Richard has accomplished with Blueprint for Truth, the architecture of destruction.
Okay, we're getting the signal from Michael G. Haskins, our stalwart engineer, that it's time to wrap up. I want to remind you, 212-209-2950. We hear the phones ringing. Keep them buzzing. Keep them buzzing into the beginning of the news. 212-209-2950. 9/11, Blueprint for Truth, the architecture of destruction, will be yours.
And above all, brothers and sisters, you know architects and engineers. You know family members who know architects and engineers. Contact them. Show them the DVD. Put them in touch with Richard. We are targeting, Richard is targeting, 1,000 architects and engineers for Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. With that threshold figure, we are going to Washington. We're going to mobilize the many. So join in this effort, brothers and sisters. Support the effort, buy the DVD, and contact those you know who are willing and able to participate in this important work.
And visit www.nyc911initiative.org and get involved with the New York City Ballot Initiative for an Authentic 9/11 Investigation. Also visit ae911truth.org. That's the website of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. And, of course, visit the Taking Aim website, www.takingaimradio.com, where we have our 7 years of program archive. And contact us at takingaim@pacbell.net. That's PACBELL.net. Keep those phones ringing, 212-209-2950, and we're out.
And, Richard, how could people get in contact with you if they'd like to do so?
Through the website, ae911truth.org, they can submit a contact us form.
ae911truth.org. Thank you very much, Richard Gage. Thank you very much, Ralph Schoenman and Maya Schoen, for another edition of Taking Aim. We have a couple of people to thank before we move on to the WBAI evening news. Let's see, Harold Davis from Brooklyn, New York, thank you very much. Called in with a subscription. Alexander Chandler from Cora.